Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm Cindy, and I host this podcast. Thanks for listening today. Very happy to be welcoming Chris Smither and Peter Mulvey together on the pod. But first, let's talk about us. Are you on Basic Folk's newsletter? It is our month-to-month email that you can sign up for at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com and click the sign up for the newsletter button. It's a once-a-month email that lets you know what's happening with your favorite folk podcast. You can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Basic Folk Pod. Follow us there for cute little videos and the like. You can also make a contribution. We are a listener-supported podcast. Everything that you're hearing is made possible by listener support. If you are a supporter, thank you so much. If you'd like to chip in, you can contribute at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com and click on the donate button. Okay, let's get into it. Chris Smither has been Peter Mulvey's mentor since way back in 1993 when the young Mulvey opened for the already seasoned Smither. The blues and folk legend liked what he heard and enjoyed the similarities in creativity and quirks, and he took that young man on the road with him. Their musical partnership has crossed paths and outlasted the digital age, the pandemic, parenthood, and the indictment of a former president. Along the way, each has worked to influence their best habits and life lessons on the other. And as far as mentor-mentee relationships go, this one is for the history books. There are also nods and shout-outs to David Goody Goodrich, Jeffrey Foucault, Chris Delmhorst, and the woman behind it all, Carol Young, a.k.a. Smither's longtime manager, a.k.a. his wife. In this rare joint interview, we address the important questions, like why do they delight in calling each other by their last names? Smither shares that he was first called by his last name in Paris when he was in school. They debate on who has the better hometown, Milwaukee or New Orleans. Actually, it's not so much a debate as a reflection on New Orleans music, since that is clearly the better spot to grow up a musician. Mulvey reflects on their musical differences, citing some of his main's inspiration to be Kendrick Lamar and Ani DiFranco versus Smither's affinity for Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan. We break down how each feels about fatherhood and try to get Smither to spill his secret to longevity. Spoiler alert, it's not from remaining still. Chris Smither's 20th album, All About the Bones, is out now. Peter Mulvey's latest is the acoustic retrospective, More Notes from Elsewhere. We're going to take a listen to a song from each of these guys before we get into the interview. Let's do All About the Bones from Chris Smither. This is the title track from his latest album. And then we'll hear a clip of Peter Mulvey's Some People. And then we'll get to our conversation with Chris Smither and Peter Mulvey on Basic Folk.
Consider your high station. Think about your fame. All of your creation depending on your fame. Ain't no doubt about it. Flesh can set the tone. But when you get down to the rhythm, man, you get right down to the bone. All about the bones.
Some people go to the synagogue. Some people go to the woods. Some people go to a shrink, and they think everybody should. Some people go crazy in plain sight on the streets of the neighborhood. I go mm-mm-mm-mm-mm-mm-mm. Some people go to Washington. Some people go to the moon. Some people go to a timeshare on the shores of a secret lagoon. Some people go the whole distance. Some people go out way too soon. I go,
Peter Mulvey and Chris Smither, so happy to have you on Basic Folk. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Glad to be here.
Okay, we're going to get right into it. Chris Smither is from New Orleans. Peter Mulvey is from Milwaukee. What do you think of the other's hometown?
He's from the wrong end of the Mississippi.
Yeah, he's from the right end of the Mississippi. That's fair. All the good stuff in American music generally came from New Orleans upwards on the Mississippi. And what we sent down was mostly taconite and lumber.
And beer.
And beer. That's also true.
I like Milwaukee fine. You know, it's really, you know, when I think about Milwaukee, I think it's such a relief after Chicago, because that's when I usually get there, is after I've driven through Chicago, which makes me unhappy no matter how nice a time I have there.
The traffic?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've only experienced New Orleans a couple of times, and once was with Chris as, you know, my tour guide. We did one of those Roots on the Rails trips down there. And, you know, it's a spectacular American city. You know, it's the confluence of so many different cultures, as opposed to Milwaukee, which is, you know, the confluence of German and Polish and Austrian and Irish. And it's just all sort of European cultures up until the Great Migration, at which point all of a sudden all of those European cultures got together and resisted every brown person with every fiber in their European beings. So I don't know. I had a much better time in New Orleans. Let's just say that.
Very good. What parallels have you noticed in each other in the way that you grew up and the way that you connected with music as young people?
Well, that's an interesting question because, well, we're both white. And we're both guilty of cultural appropriation to a certain extent. That's an interesting thing to talk about in a way, you know. But it's funny, you know, we're just about a generation apart in age. And to a certain extent, Peter's always felt like exactly that, like what the sort of person I would have had if I'd had a son, you know, who got into the same kind of music that I did. And, you know, yeah. Like the best sort of offspring, you know, he has different ideas about what makes a song good and what they should, you know. Our whole approach to a sound check, you should attend a sound check with both of us sometime so that you could just find out how different we are. And then, but we laugh at the same things, you know.
Can you give us like a general rundown, like a quick rundown of maybe how you each act in a sound check?
I'm always telling them to turn down the bottom end, you know, in the guitar, because it gets too boomy for me, you know, and it obscures a whole bunch of other things. And Peter's always telling him, turn up the bass until it hurts. I want it to beat against your heart.
Yes. Yeah, we have polar opposite sounds, that's for sure. You know, I can name another thing, which is, you know, my mother got her master's in journalism. My father got a degree in philosophy and theology, and your father was a scholar. I think we both came from highly literate households. And then we, both of us, collided with colloquial music forms. But we were drawn to the same sorts of people. We were drawn to Dylan, and we were drawn to Joni Mitchell. We were drawn to Mark Knopfler. because they were doing the same thing. They were attempting to be literate within a sort of a roots thing. And then, you know, I just, because I am younger, I went, I think, a little more naturally towards also like Kendrick Lamar or Ani DeFranco. But that, I think you're right, is just a matter of the generations. I suspect if you'd come up, you know, 25 years later, you too would have been more immersed in those guys as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't quite thought of that. You know, it's really, but you know, when getting into the parallels, we're both into books, we're both into quotes, we're both into how succinctly somebody can put something. You know, that's all. That's part of songwriting, and it's, you know, and it's the sort of thing that delights both of us. We ride along in the car together, throwing these things at one another and going, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Things like that.
Yeah.
Oh, my. I would love to hear. So you guys are touring again for the first time in quite a while. And Peter posted something like, yeah, it's been the first time we've been able to just like ride in the car together. So like, what does a car ride between Chris Smither and Peter Mulvey look like when you're on tour and you have like an 8-hour drive in front of you?
Well, these days, you know, there's so many podcasts that you can listen to and vent all your frustrations. But you know, like, we're both into politics in a big way, you know, and you know, and actually, we're both very, you know, politically, we're both pretty well aligned, you know, on a sort of liberal axis. You know, there's no real differences there, except that Peter still has a little bit of the idealist left in him. I've had most of that kicked out of me, you know, but not enough that I wallow in despair.
Right. I got to say, I was impressed. The middle leg of the tour we just came off of, somebody finally read our writer and indicted and convicted the former president on 34 felony counts. Like, we've been asking for that since we could tell a venue what we wanted. And then in Philadelphia, we got it. We got to go on stage and say, thank you.
I bet you told that same exact joke on stage.
Not even better. I got to walk out on stage and say, so how's your day in history going?
That's pretty good. I think this is more true for Peter when it comes to Chris and the rest of the world. But you two will often refer to each other by last names. I think like Smither for sure gets a lot of use. I tried to go to chrissmither.com today, and my computer was like, that doesn't exist. It's smither.com. What's your feeling about calling your friend by their last name, getting called by your last name? Like, when did it start happening for each of you?
You go first.
You know, when I was 12 years old, I was in school in Paris. And in Paris, in a French public school, 6th and 7th graders always refer to each other by their last names. Yeah. I mean, I can remember at least a half a dozen last names in that room, and I cannot tell you any one of their first names. But there was Lenormand, there was Porte, there was Leveille, there was a bunch of others, and I was Smither. Alors, Smither, qu'est-ce que tu vas faire aujourd'hui? And it kind of stuck. And as a matter of fact, you know, Suitcase Junket, Matt Lorenz, his manager, often refers to me as Smither. And every time she does, she apologizes for it. She says, we always call you Smither. And I say, but that's my name. You know, she says.
Yeah.
But Mulvey, I mean, everybody calls Mulvey Mulvey.
Yeah, but I will say Goody really makes it likelier that everyone's going to call me Mulvey. Goody has called me Mulvey since forever. David Goodrich has referred to me as Mulvey. And I know why. Because he was in this cadre of David's. His name is David Goodrich. And he was in this cadre of brilliant musicians, David Goodrich, David Brody, and David Krajcnik. And all of them went by Brody, Goody, and Kradgy. Like, that was how everyone told them apart. And so I think it was very natural for Goody to call me Malvi. But and now Chris does, and Chris and Jeff, back from Redbird days, they call me Malvi. The most entertaining part of that was Goody's 15-year-old son was on the road with us, and he kept referring to me as Malvi. It's incredibly charming coming from someone who just grew a mustache.
That's right. Wow. And he never says Mr. Malvi either.
Nope, just Malvi.
It almost gives me the vibe of like a kid calling their parent by their first name.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. I would like to talk about David Goodrich in just a bit. But first, I went back and listened, Chris, to our interview that we did a few years ago, and it was really good, actually. Peter, I couldn't listen to our interview because I broke down and wept in it, so I didn't want to revisit that today. But it really reminded me that Chris Smither is a huge reader, and it started off when he was very young. Peter, what's your track record as a young reader, and how has your practice for reading changed and evolved over time?
Well, my parents had the Encyclopedia Britannica, and they had books of Greek myth. I was reading Greek myth by the time I was 10 or 11. I'd read most of The Lord of the Rings by the time I was 11 or 12. I was a relentless reader. I come from, a long line of Irish people, and so that was bound to happen. And I have to say, Chris is systematically even further into it than I am. Like he has the Oxford English Dictionary in his home and has the magnifying glass because the print is so small so you can look things up. And he has, the book of that great book of, what is the great book of quotations you have?
I have two or three of them, but the first one is the Oxford Book of Quotations,
yeah, that's the one I'm thinking. Yeah. And my reading has evolved in that during the pandemic, like everybody else, I think the internet ate half my brain, and then right in the middle of that, I became a parent, and I got a 2.5-year-old, and I'm just now beginning to actually read physical books again. I feel like I've been reduced to a blank slate or, to sort of a person whose memory has been wiped. I can just wake up and try to relearn all of Western civilization and Eastern civilization and human history.
I've been thinking recently that I should quit reading things on a tablet. It's so convenient, because you can carry so many books with you. I used to have an incredibly heavy briefcase that was actually full of books. It didn't have anything in it that I needed other than the books. And then I discovered iPads, and I started reading everything on them. And that was very good for a while, but I think it's done something to me. I think it's affected not only how much I read, but the depth, the length of time that I spend. I used to get totally lost in books. I would sit in a big chair or on the couch for hours and read half a novel or half a good portion of a historical narrative or something like that. And now I find that, 20 minutes seems like an awfully long time. And I don't know whether it's the machine that I'm dealing with that. So I'm thinking about making a conscious switch is what I'm trying to say. I don't know, maybe it just has to do with old age, and how long my eyes can take it, although I see better than I used to. thanks to modern medicine, they gave me some new eyes. it's a miracle, right?
A total miracle. We're all very happy for you, Chris. The origin story of Chris Smither and Peter Mulvey is that Peter was 24, Chris was 49. And this is from a newsletter Peter sent out recently. He said, I opened a show back when he was 24. He told me he liked what I do. Somehow that was enough, and soon I was opening tours for him all through the U.S. and Europe. It got me my start, and even better, we became friends. Back to the early days, Chris, what did you like about Peter, and what did you see in him, and when did you know that there was like a deeper connection for you two?
I think, well, the first thing that happened was that he captured my audience. That doesn't happen very often, that an opening act develops that sort of bond with my audience. My audience is, I should, in their defense, I should say they are unfailingly polite to whoever is opening. But, you know, he had them. I could tell from the back room, and I said, I got to go check this kid out. And I went out and sat and listened to him, and I could see why. You know, it was fun. It was, you know, his stuff was full of keen observations about human nature. It was well expressed. It was tightly expressed. You know, there was a succinctness to the writing, and it made sense. I didn't hear a single cliched rhyme or cliched metaphor. And you know, then we started talking, and his conversation, you know, the social aspect of it was identical to the sort of rapport that he had developed with the audience. You know, it was just toned down to a one-on-one level as opposed to a large-scale level. And it was more or less the way you make friends with anybody. Oh, that's somebody I'd like to know. You know?
Yeah, and I would like to point out the one thing that I've changed the most. The one thing that has changed the most about the way I do things is that I am more fun than I used to be. And part of that was, you know, I had a lot of energy in my show when I was 24, but it wasn't as funny as you. When I was an awfully serious guy at 24. And, we're both still serious people, but you got to break it up with a little bit of laughter, you know? And I feel like that, like watching that, like just, you know, any old lyric of yours, just this is a lady, she blind with the scales, got a big letter opener. She's been reading my mail, and I don't know why this should shame me, but it does somehow. I don't care what you say, she don't look like a lady now. Like, that is funny, and it says quite a bit about, you know, about the serious side of things, like the difficulty you and I and everyone in the world has in trying to be fair, even to themselves and the people around them. It's like it's a tall order. It's hard. But, you know, if you got up on stage and said, it's difficult to be fair, even to yourself, it's a tall order, it's hard, people would be like, what am I on, Dr. Phil? You know, like the audience would be funnier than you. And it's a better idea than to be funnier than the audience.
Chris, what did including Peter on your shows and becoming his mentor teach you about being a musician and about, like, being a teacher, showing someone the ropes in the world you were in?
Well, that's difficult to answer in a sense because I'm not conscious of doing it. You know, I'm just sort of being who I am, in a sense, and Peter picks up on the parts that he likes. I'm doing essentially what was done for me. You know, it's a pass it on situation. When I first started trying to do this, there were people in the Cambridge scene, especially people like Tom Rush and Eric von Schmidt, all of whom thought, who were very encouraging to me. They thought a great deal of what I was doing. People like John Hammond Jr., who had is only like 3 years older than me, but by the time I got to Cambridge, he was an established figure, and I loved what he was doing, and he just sort of befriended me, and yet he'd been doing this professionally for compared to my age, it was a long, long time. He'd already been doing it for 3 or 4 years. I was, 20 years old, so that's like a considerable percentage of my age. And so just by hanging around and watching, I learned so much about how to carry myself on stage, how to be assertive and at the same time maintain a sense of humility and not come across as too full of myself, you know, but to still have some confidence, you know, in what I was doing. It's a tricky little thing. It's a tricky thing to do. You spend your life learning how to relate to audiences, and you know, it takes an amazing amount of time to realize that the audience actually wants you to be good. It's not an adversarial relationship, and once you've learned that, then you have to learn how to exploit it without making the audience feel that they're being used. I mean, it's a very fine little dance. And by watching people, I learned that. And I just assumed Peter learned things like that by watching me, because I was that much farther along in the process than he was.
Yeah, that is exactly it. I mean, there's an old saying, you can learn these things, but you can't teach them.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
So to me, it seems like there should be at least two other people in this very fun interview that you all have agreed to do today. Also, is this the first time you've been interviewed together in a situation like this? I couldn't find anything online.
There's one coming up.
Yeah. And then there was one. It was you, me, and Jeff Folkoff on some radio station. Remember that? And like someone made a bootleg.
Nashville.
I listened to that today.
Yeah, that was it.
Actually, I listened to that today. It was great. Mm. So the other...
Yeah, but it's really nice to talk without Jeff in the mix. I just gotta say.
Well, he's one of the people that I was thinking should be here. And the other person would be David Goody Goodrich, who we'll get to. But first, I want to talk about Jeff, Jeffrey Foucault, who actually has a new record coming out on September 6th, The Universal Fire. So he should be here. We just didn't know, Jeff. You didn't tell us. Anyways, maybe we could do another one with Jeff in the mix at some point. But let's talk about Jeffrey. Back in the O's in Boston in the early 2000s, my friend, who you both might know, Michelle Conceison, explained to me, we already went over this, Chris Smither is Peter Mulvey's mentor. Peter Mulvey is Jeffrey Foucault's mentor. You all had the same management at the time, and it was explained to me that this was like set up very intentionally. What was that setup like for you guys, especially in the days that Jeff was coming up on the scene in New England throughout the 2000s decade?
Well, I should say I met Jeff through the Cafe Carp, which is sort of my hometown venue in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. I'm from Milwaukee, which is 50 miles away, but the Carp has been the center of my singer-songwriterdom since I began. And Jeff is from the next town over, Whitewater. And I met him through the Carp. And I'm not entirely sure I'm as much of a mentor to him. I was, you know, I was just the guy who sort of got him on stage, encouraged him to come out east. And then there's another person who's sort of unspoken in all this, but Carol Young, who is Chris's manager and partner. Carol managed me for a little while, and that company also managed Jeff. But I've been thinking about this for the last month, Chris. Like, Carol is certainly among my other mentors.
Mine too.
She just is. Yeah, right. Like, Carol's wife, Chris, who has also been his manager for a long time, is one of the most honorable, honest people that you're ever going to meet. And she, you know, I mean, the difference, of course, is that Chris and Jeff Foucault and I, we all sort of go up on stage. And so everyone knows who we are. But I think it is fair to say that all three of us have managed to marry people that are, you know, we've married upward. So I'm going to say that. And As for, you know, as for Jeff's mentorhood, I did have to teach him not just to play the guitar, but also to read and write. And so, and tie his shoes. So I wouldn't say mentor so much as remedial, you know, instructor. Oh, man. I had to teach him to lie.
Okay, Peter. Very fun.
Sorry.
We're having fun.
Can't resist.
I don't, you know, it's funny. I don't have any sense of mentorship to Jeffrey at all, but I do have a sense that, somehow, not somehow, in some very specific ways, I affected the course of his life. Because one of the things that, I really enjoy doing is taking guys like Peter and Jeffrey and, Chris Delmhorst to England and Ireland on tour as support acts, and because it basically because it makes me look good. You know, the Irish are always saying, and the English are always saying, where do you find these people? They're fabulous. I mean, and the thing is that they then take off and, you know, have a presence and a profile of their own in those countries. And I took Chris Delmhorst. Chris Delmhorst had put out an EP of five songs that I thought were just fabulous. And I said, you got to come to Ireland with me and do this thing. And so we did. And we had just a wonderful time. And I had taken Jeffrey already on, a tour to both England and Ireland. And Peter had been, I think, twice with me, at least twice, wasn't it, Peter?
Yeah.
So all three of them then decided that they would form, you know, a sort of collaborative effort, and all three of them go as a package to those things. And then it turned out that Chris and Jeffrey wound up getting getting hooked up together and eventually married. So they're an item now. So I thought it was, you know, I was pretty fond of Chris myself, you know, but I was already married, so I can't begrudge I can't begrudge him that. But you know, I like to think that I had something to do with, you know, a pretty productive union there. It's you know, and as far as what Peter was saying about Carol, he's absolutely right. In a way, she's probably more important to all of us than any, well, than she ever will get credit for it. Much as I credit her all the time, you know, it's, she prefers to remain in the background. But, you know, in the scheme of things, I often think of myself, and I've said this in public, I'm just a locomotive. You know, it takes an engineer and an oilman and a brakeman and everybody else to run the machine and make it do something productive. I'm just the power source. And I would be nowhere. I wouldn't go anywhere. I wouldn't do anything. I would get nothing done if it weren't for Carol Young.
What's it like when you guys are like hanging out with each other? Like, how often are you in touch with each other? How much of that is like talking about music, talking about your careers, and how much of that is just like, you know, goofing around? I did see that Peter tried to garden with Chris recently. Didn't go so well for him. But what's it like when, you two get together?
Well, he does. He's never gardened with me. I called him up and sort of dragooned him into some forced servitude. You know, he's I needed help building these big garden boxes, you know, so I called him up and said, come on over and help me out. Sometimes he calls me and says, let's take a bike ride, and we do that. But to tell you the truth, you know, we don't talk about the music part of it much. What we talk about is the thematic stuff that winds up in the music. And you know, we sort of explore expression and sentiment and whether it's valid or not, all those questions, and the questions have a way of turning up in the work. But we don't really look at each other's stuff. You know, we look at each other's stuff when it's completed. You know, we look at it, and right. I'll look at Peter's stuff and recognize aspects of stuff that we've talked about, and I'm sure he does the same with me. but it's not something that we talk about directly, unless we happen to be in the studio together, which sometimes happens, you know, or on stage together. But.
Right. And that, you know, one of the things we talk about on bike rides or while, you know, working post hole diggers or whatever, tends to be the philosophers and the poets that are further out along those lines of expression than we're ever going to be, you know, like both of us have a great admiration. We've devoted our lives to music. And then there's, you know, there's people like Dan Dennett or Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens who devoted their lives to rationality, or, you know, great historians or, what was the Kansas City poet who used to live teach at UMass Amherst, James Tate.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like just these presences who have gone further down roads than Chris and I ever will. And so that's where we find these sentiments and these thoughts that then we sort of bring back and tussle with them and put them into our lyrics. And then it's interesting to recognize, oh, that's right. That's when Chris was deep into consciousness, you know, or like, all right, that's when Mulvey was deep into Seamus Heaney. Like, it just comes leaking out of his stuff. Like, and, you know, almost none of our audience is going to notice that stuff. So that's another reason I'm glad I've met Chris, is because he's going to get things in a way that almost nobody else is going to, because we happen to have about six philosophers in common.
Wow. Okay, cool.
Nerdery.
Yeah.
Nerdery.
Here it is.
I could have said that in one word.
All right, let's talk about Goody. David Goody Goodrich. A little bit of background if those listening do not know Goody. So he lives in Austin, Texas, as of now. He lived in the Boston area for a while, went to Berkeley, has worked with you both. But okay, so it is kind of tough to find this information online, so I might need some biographical information about like timeline. But I think it was Peter he worked with first. He produced Peter's Rapture album in 1995. Chris has been working with him since 2003, including on Chris's new album, All About the Bones. And Chris, in our last interview, you said it wasn't easy to find him. So how did Mulvey start working with Goody, and then how did Smithers start working with Goody?
Well, I can start. So I was 24 years old, and I was working at a guitar shop in Boston called the Music Emporium. And Goody walked in, and he asked to play an old steel guitar, an old National resonator guitar, and he played Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground by Blind Willie Johnson. I thought, what is that music and who are you? And so I asked him, what is that music and who are you? And we just became friends. But he's originally from Prince George's County in Maryland, and he went to the Berklee School of Music, and he's an extraordinarily gifted musician, and he and I bonded and talked music. And I think the thing that I noticed about him very early on is that he is able to challenge nearly anybody's idea without being pugnacious about it. And it's an incredible asset as a producer, you know, like, and a lot of it is just not what he says, but the manner in which he says it. Like, I remember bringing a piece of music to him and saying, yeah, I think I'm going to turn this into, another one of those spoken word pieces that I do. And he managed to say, I think that's just because you can't think of a melody. And I don't think you can't think of a melody. I think you just think you can't think of a melody. But somehow he can say something to that effect with this inviting tone. And next thing you know, I'd written a melody, and that was the tune Grace. And so, you know, I just leaned on him for a while. And when his band broke up, I brought him on the road with me as a sideman. And we wrote together, and he produced records for me. And then, you know, our lives sort of took different courses right around the time that Chris Smither, who had gotten to know him through me, sort of picked up the thread. And those two have had an even longer and more productive You know, we're all still friends, but generally speaking now, Goody mostly works with Chris. So, Chris, you want to take over from where Goody hopped onto your train?
I was in a situation, I just finished, to do a little backstory, making records up until, I think, my fourth or fifth album, something, or maybe sixth or seventh album, was a chore. I dreaded it. It was like a final exam to me every time. I knew I had to do these things, and I liked having the records, but, you know, it was a struggle. I would go in and it always felt like I was talking to people who didn't really understand what it was that made my stuff worthwhile. And I didn't know enough about the technical aspects of music to explain it to anybody of what I was trying to do. And the first time I really enjoyed making records, even a little bit, was when I was working with Stephen Bruton in Texas. And Stephen taught me how to have fun in the studio. He really did. We did three albums together, and basically I sensed that we were out of ideas and it wasn't going the direction that I wanted to. So I started trying to find somebody else, and I wasn't having a lot of luck. I thought I'd had I'd found the right person twice, and they both bailed out on me. And Peter actually said, "You should get Goody to do this." And Goody came over to my house, and I played him the material that I had ready for the stuff. And he said, "I think we should just sit at your table here and play it, and then find some other people to play along with it." That was the way we did the first record together. Well, that was fine with me, because that meant that nobody was going to try to change what I was doing. Somebody was actually going to try to work with the material at hand, you know. So that was kind of brilliant. He told me later that the whole prospect scared him to death, but he really wanted to do it. He didn't seem scared, though, not to me. And since then, I agree wholeheartedly with everything that Peter has said about Goody. He's a schooled musician. He never lets it get in his way. It never interferes with his appreciation and instinctive feel for the tunes and for what might happen with the tunes. And now it's gotten to the point where he's an integral part of the creative process for me. This last project, for instance, I was having a terrible time getting started. I never have any problems coming up with a guitar riff and a nice musical idea and even a melody, you know. But the lyrics, I sometimes have trouble getting it going and getting into it. And he sees that. He can see that. He can sense that from afar. It's not that hard, but, you know, I'm always surprised when people figure out what I'm thinking. He said at one point, "I'm coming up." And he left Texas. He flew up to Massachusetts, and we had a few days of sessions up here. And there's just, with everybody needs somebody like this. He walks into the room and everything changes. Everything changes. And there's a catalytic effect that is palpable. And it's not like a lightness comes on or a darkness. Sometimes it's one way and sometimes it's the other, but nothing stays the same.
That's amazing. After 20 years.
He'll pick up a guitar. He'll say, "Play me something, you know, and I'll play something," and he'll just join in. Now this happened when he half wrote three of the best songs on this new record. He sat down, he picked up a guitar, and he just played this little bass lick that he's probably heard me play 1,000 times when I'm warming up. It just was boom, 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 boom. I started riffing off of that, and he looks at me and he says, "Sing something." And without a moment's hesitation, I said, "It's all about the bones. Boom, 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 boom." He said, "Write that down." So I wrote it down, you know, and then that's where the title song came from. Then he said, later on, he says, I've got a little kind of a very Smither-like progression here. And I listen to this, and he starts playing it. And And I said, you're right, that's very me. And I sat down and started playing it with him, you know, and worked out a version that was virtually identical to what he was playing with very little change to it. And it was towards the end of the afternoon, and we weren't going to start working again until the next day. And he said, okay, you got it. Now, he says, go write something. And I just sort of looked at him, and he says, go on. He says, you can do it. I still believe in you. Ah, you see? And so I wrote a song called Still Believe in You. And it's, I don't know, that's just how it happens. You know, he's got people skills that are not flashy, they're not flamboyant.
But, that's a good way to put it. He does have great people skills.
It's effective.
Mm-hmm. He's like your boss, Chris. I was texting Peter about the idea to interview you both on the podcast, and I said it'll be half about music and half about longevity. Peter's response, I have yet to really prove anything about longevity. So, gentlemen, we are now in the longevity portion of the interview. So, I told Peter this is our chance to learn from the great wizard of eternal youth. Chris Smither is turning 80 years old this year. Mm-hmm. And I've heard so much from Peter about how Chris can carry heavy bags of dry cement. Chris Smither can outrun him by 3 miles. We heard about the garden boxes. So, Chris, teach us all you know about staying youthful, vibrant, and strong.
The secret is to keep getting up in the morning. As long as you keep getting up in the morning, you'll be all right. I don't know. It's a strange thing. People in my family tend to live a long time. And then they die suddenly, you know, so maybe that'll happen to me. I don't really know. The perseverance aspect of it is what's interesting to me. I've never had like an overnight success. I've never had an immediate success at anything. And yet I'm standing here after almost 8 decades, and I've never been, in a sense, more successful than I am now. It's all been a steady rise up. The I Ching keeps saying, perseverance furthers, just keep at it. And you'll get there. And so far it's working out for me. I don't pretend to understand it. I'm eternally grateful. I keep waking up in the morning and saying, I'm all right. I'm still okay. I didn't expect to live this long. I really didn't. And I don't take any of it for granted. There's no secret. I mean, there are secrets to it. The secret is to, quit smoking, quit drinking. If you do those things, don't do them no more. Don't eat anything that doesn't sound like food when you read it on the label.
What's your diet, Chris?
Oh, I eat lots and lots of really good stuff, and I have a very Catholic taste. I mean, it's right across the board. I like all food. You know, I don't like things that have long chemical names. I try to avoid those. I eat as little fast food as I possibly can, although the life of a touring musician mandates that you're going to wind up eating some of that no matter what. But I like to cook. That's very important. If you want to eat well, you should learn to cook, because you can do it very inexpensively. And now, it was only within the last few years that I've learned to get enough sleep. Not getting enough sleep will I'm not sure, I can't speak from experience, but it looks to me like it kills a lot of people, not getting enough sleep as a regular thing. But I think more than anything, it's just trying to stay interested. If you get bored, then you're going to quit because your body figures out that you're bored. And it says, okay, let's call it a day.
Yeah. That's a good one. Don't be bored. Yeah. Live forever. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think of all these longevity bros down in Austin, Texas that are trying to live to be 200 years old?
Well, they should make sure they've got something to do if they're going to live that long.
Yeah. I just read a really beautiful article where a guy said that his way of living longer is to live longer in reverse, which is to say he journals all the time and he writes down what his kids did and he writes down what his grandkids did and he collects and writes about what his friends did, and he lives his life considerably more thoroughly because he considers the lives and the sayings and the ins and outs and the events of all the people he cares about. And that struck me as really wise, especially because he stacked it up against, exactly these guys who get blood transfusions and have, devices that measure their erections during the course of a night's sleep. All of that just doesn't sound nearly as rewarding as just savoring the life that you are living. So I will say, Chris taught me to keep moving. I still remember I was maybe in my late 20s and I was on Dar Williams' tour bus when he first hit me with the hard sell. He was like, Moby, listen, when you were 18, you couldn't help but be healthy and fit. But now you gotta take up exercise. A guy like mine, so he would have been 50-ish, 51, 52. He's like, a guy my age, I'm just keeping pace with the body's own natural deterioration. But you're going to feel like someone dropped a whole new engine under the hood.
Was he right?
He was. Wow. I took up running. I took up long distance bicycling, and it did wonders for my appetite. It did wonders for my depression. It did wonders for my singing. Like 2 years into that, and everyone was like, what? I never thought of you as a powerful singer. Like, well, I have twice as much lung capacity as I used to. I guess those things might be related.
Mm. Nice. So on fatherhood, you are each dads. Happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
What have you each learned from each other about being a parent?
I was a parent a long time before Peter was. Well, not a long time, but, 20 years.
17 years.
Yeah. Right. 17 years, and I didn't know much about it going in, and I know more about it now that it's too late to do anything about it, that's a... But, I was not a father until I was 60 years old. And there are things that are probably not ideal about that, but on the whole, I'm a much better parent than I would have been if I'd become a father at the age that most people are designed to become parents. There's a lot of stress that's taken out of it. When I was young, and if I'd had a kid, all the very predictable financial, constrictions and worry and stuff about this, that, and the other. And by the time I was a parent, most of that had been taken care of. Things were more firmly established. I was a more secure person, both in a practical way and also in an emotional way. I was just a much more stable person. It's absolutely remarkable to watch a kid grow up from the standpoint of somebody who's basically already grown up. I'm as much of a grown-up as I'm ever going to be at this point. And I don't think I realized until I was, until I was a parent, you know, just how young my parents were when they had me. I mean, my father was 28 years old. He still had a long, long ways to go, believe me. And to his credit, he realized it, you know, before he got to the end. You know, he realized how much he'd changed in that time. And not too many regrets, but, you know, the kids, they don't come with a handbook, so, you know, you sort of have to grow along with it. But I will say that and this is a very commonplace thing to say, but it's probably the most important thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
There
was something very reassuring across the 17 years that I watched Chris and Carol parenting. Because, of course, kids take over the majority of your bandwidth. And I was amazed at how much they got done. They almost seemed to get better at their own, you know. Carol almost, I think, became a better manager and sort of order of operations, you know, person. And you became almost a better writer. Mm. And a better performer when all of that got shoved into the margin because almost all of your attention had to go on this being, you know? And that was really reassuring to me. You know, I also became a parent quite late in life. I was 52. And and I agree with you. It is such a privilege to watch a child grow. I think you'll recognize this, Chris. Like, I've always enjoyed reading books by people that are smarter than me and listening to music by musicians that are, you know, are more accomplished than I am or deeper or, you know, I love things where they're a little ahead of you and you can learn something from them. I have never felt so dwarfed by the enormity of a human mind and soul as my own, you know, 3-month-old and 6-month-old. They're just knitting together a personhood and making these connections out of the ether. They're like these giant engines, you know, trapped in this little drooling snotty body. It's sort of humbling and also softening. It really softens you. And I think, you know, most women could use to be softened a little where it really counts, to learn to be a little more yielding, a little more patient, and a little more steady, you know?
Before I let you guys go, we're going to do a very fun game for the lightning round. Hmm. The game is called Which One? The premise of the game is I'm going to ask a question like, which one likes dogs? And then I'm going to do 3, 2, 1. You both answer at the same time. The answer could be Chris. The answer could be Peter, none of us, both of us, and you can say your own name.
All
right. Pretty straightforward, I think. Let us do this. Okay. Which one is the driver? 3, 2, 1.
No,
Chris.
Gonna wait for the countdown.
Okay. I'm sorry about that.
That's all right. Okay. Which one brings the snacks? 3, 2, 1.
Neither.
Peter.
Okay. Which one is on time? 3, 2, 1.
Both.
Both of us.
All right. Nice. Okay. This one is just think about over the course of your life, not in your current situation, but possibly current situation. Which one is the better roommate? 3, 2, 1.
Chris.
Okay, I don't know because we seldom are in the same room. Yeah, if you're talking about like hotel rooms.
No, I'm talking about over the course of your life.
Oh,
are you a good roommate? Or is Peter the better roommate?
I think Peter. He's more self-contained than he's neither. Okay, what's your reasoning?
Because I don't feel that, you know, I don't think I am. I just feel like I don't get things done. I don't get things picked up. I don't, you know, I try. Maybe that's what makes me good, right? Because I at least
we'll
try.
We'll have to check with Carol.
That's right.
All right, just a few more here. Which one is the jokester? 3, 2, 1.
Both.
Peter.
When you say jokester, do you mean somebody who tells jokes or plays jokes?
It's whatever interpretation.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. I love that one. That was my favorite so far. Which one is going to the beach? 3, 2, 1.
Neither.
Either?
Wow. Yeah. Okay. All right. This is the last one. Which one is planning your surprise party? 3, 2, 1.
Peter.
Yeah, that'd be me.
All right. Great. That's awesome. Wonderful. Thank you so much. This has been a real blast. We'll do it again with Jeff and Goody, hopefully. Thanks again, guys. This was great.
All right, Cindy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good to see you again.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can go to basicfolk.com. Check us out on the SiriusXM app by searching for Basic Folk. You can find us on folkalley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can also listen wherever you get podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend. Like, share it with your mentor. If they're like not a music person, you can be like, listen, I would love you to listen to this podcast about a mentor and a mentee talking together, and then maybe they'll actually enjoy the music. You never know. All right. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.